Coming up today, how much energy does Bitcoin use? We try and work out the answer. Plus, when is a Yeti not a Yeti? All that and more coming up. You're listening to episode 346 of the WiredUK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
And longtime Wired contributor and first-time Wired podcaster, Nicole Coby.
Hello.
Now, we start with facts. Nicole, I won't put you on the spot. Matt, you can go first.
Okay, so I don't know if this is just something that is news to me, but essentially, so I went to visit a cemetery a couple of weeks ago in France, in Paris.
Lovely, lovely.
Right, and there were so many graves there. And I was thinking, well, you know, why are these graves so old? Why are they kind of hanging around? And it turned out that actually the cemetery is so oversubscribed that basically now you have to buy graves on like a lease. So you buy a grave for like 10 years or 30 years or 50 years. And then basically if no one's around to renew your lease, your remains just get disinterred and then maybe cremated and put somewhere else. Hmm. And because of this, this cemetery is called like Père Lachaise in Paris. It has like 3 million people there because they get moved to the crematorium because they're like, you know, disinterred. So kind of cool.
Yeah. Whereas, so I found a related fact. I found my great, great, great grandfather buried. Great, great. Yeah. Anyway, he died in the late 1800s. He's buried in a graveyard in London. And it's still there. And no one had visited this grave in years and years and decades. And it was completely covered in weeds. You couldn't get to it. I had to like fight my way through the undergrowth to find this thing. But it's still there, which is kind of ridiculous when you think, well, where do you put all the people?
Yeah, so there's such a huge premium for cemetery space. So if you were in Paris, that wouldn't be allowed, right? If your grave seems to be untended, they give it kind of 2 years, even if there's still a lease on it. And then they're like, nah, we're going to dig this person up because, you know, we could resell that grave. So
it's eminently sensible.
It makes sense.
A lot of people, not a lot of space. Prime real estate, even for the dead. Nicole, what did you learn this week?
This week I learned that Christmas lights in the U.S. use 6.63 terawatt hours per year, which isn't a lot in terms of American standards. It's 0.2% for Americans, but it's how much El Salvador goes through. So
in an entire year?
No, this is like, for an entire year.
Not of Christmas lights?
No, not El Salvadorian Christmas lights.
So Americans making their houses and streets look fancy for Christmas uses up the same amount of energy as an entire fairly substantial country.
Yeah, or apparently 14 million refrigerators.
Well, I mean, twinkly lights are nice and all, but climate change is a thing. So think before you completely coat your large suburban hole in lights.
So you don't have Christmas lights on?
A few. I have a small tree. Yes, it's sensible. I learned this week about sheep sex, or more specifically, sheep sex on farms. So how do you tell which sheep has had sex with which sheep? I mean, the answer's written down on the note, so I won't keep you in suspense. So the male sheep traditionally on a farm will be fitted with a harness, and on the bottom of that harness, on their belly, or kind of on the back of their belly towards their groin, is a pad that has crayon on it, like wax crayon. And when the male sheep mounts the female sheep to mate, that crayon rubs off on her back. And the different male sheeps, or rams, I guess, the different rams have different coloured pads. So as a farmer, you can tell how many orange patches are on the back of the females, and how many red patches, and how many blue patches.
What if there's one of each?
Well, I guess then it gets a bit confusing. Yes, so from an online product listing for the Mastermark Ram Crayon for Harness, orange, for use with ram harness, an easy and effective way to keep track of mated sheep. A block of crayon which is attached to the ram harness and rubbed onto the sheep's back during mating. There you go. It's a low-tech solution.
I like that.
Yeah.
It'd be good if the sheep had kind of like a drawer, you know, like a pad of paper on their back, and then you could kind of draw stuff on it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Art.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So there's some innovation. We'll pitch that to the sheep farmers. From sheep to yetis, or maybe not yetis, this week there was some scientific research published that's trying to persuade people that these things really aren't real.
Yeah, so they're probably not real. So you might be kind of surprised, because I guess, you know, maybe we think kind of Yeti is a bit like a Father Christmas, where it's kind of accepted that it probably doesn't exist. But actually, it's kind of really important to like Himalayan people, especially kind of Tibetan and Nepalese like Buddhist monasteries. They have loads and loads of like Yeti relics.
Right.
And to them, you know, they're kind of like soldiers' relics, and they're really important for use within rituals, for kind of like spiritual things, for kind of healing and stuff like that. So they've got loads of weird stuff, kind of like withered paws and scalps and, you know, Yeti poo.
Right. So when people think of Yeti or Bigfoot or Sasquatch, they might think of shaky video camera footage from the United States or North America in general. Whereas here we have actual physical evidence of Yetis in the form of, as you said, shriveled paws and droppings and hair and stuff like this. So there's evidence to go and analyse, and someone's actually been able to go and do this.
Yeah, exactly. So there's actually a really long history of analysing this kind of like Yeti evidence, because a lot of these monasteries say that these kind of relics have been around for centuries. So they're, you know, a really important part of their history. And basically, there have been loads of previous attempts to go and analyse these. So strangely, the Daily Mail sent an expedition in the kind of 1950s. They got one of these scalps, and they, you know, they checked out the hair, and they were like, oh, this is actually some kind of hoofed animal. We don't really know what it is. A more recent study, I think it's in the kind of 90s or 2000s, that said, oh, this is some kind of like half polar bear, half other bear kind of thing.
Right.
But now we have more of a definitive read. So this new study is probably the most kind of comprehensive look at these kind of group of Yeti relics that we've really ever had.
And it's a bear.
Well, it's three bears.
Get too excited.
Yeah, and I got really excited over that. So three different types of bears. So basically, they took these nine relics. And like I said, there's all this kind of stuff. So kind of like skin samples and hair samples and bone samples. And out of these nine relics, they determined that eight of the relics were three different types of bear. And let me just double check what types of bear these are. Yeah, we've got the Asian black bear, the Himalayan brown bear, or the Tibetan brown bear. The ninth relic was actually from a dog. So that's kind of disappointing.
Yes, and they might have got a little bit of a clue from the language in the Himalayas. The name for a Yeti is Mecha or Misha?
Yeah, so there's actually loads and loads of different names. But Mecha is one of them. I think it's a Tibetan word. And it means man bear. Loads of different words. It's kind of like cattle bear. It's kind of like things that scares stock away. And I think this is kind of partly, I was talking to the researcher that was kind of behind this. And it was a team from the University at Buffalo in New York. And basically they say that I think where a lot of this legend comes from is basically you have this thing that scares your livestock away. And that's a lot of where people's experience with the Yeti kind of came from. And really what it is these kind of like quite elusive bears that when they're kind of obscured by snow or whatever, but they're doing kind of scary stuff, you know, they can rear up on their hind legs, they look kind of like men.
And it turns out that debunking Yetis is telling us an awful lot more about bears and how they moved around, where they come from, and the different subspecies and where they broke off from the main bear lineage.
Yeah, totally. So what's kind of fascinating is actually if you think of like brown bear, you kind of think of your generic bear, they're incredibly successful. So you have like your Eurasian bear, your North American brown bear, you have Himalayan bears as well. But essentially they're more or less like the same bear. Like they're a bear subspecies, but really, you know, this one bear has been incredibly popular. But what we can kind of see here with what happens in the Himalayas is because it's such a kind of like unique environment, these kind of like this subsect of bears has probably been separated about 650,000 years ago from this kind of lineage. And we've seen we've got these kind of like quite unique bear species kind of like starting to evolve. And this is part of the reason why it's been so hard to really work out what they were, because until we had the kind of DNA, you know, the level of kind of like detail in our DNA, we didn't really exactly know like where they're fitting in. But actually we've realized that these Himalayan brown bears in particular are actually pretty kind of like different to the rest of the brown bears, and they're pretty unique. So it's quite a cool finding if you're interested in bear ecology.
Yeah, and we see a really clear difference between the legends in Asian countries around Yetis and creatures like this and in white North American culture, where it's very much sort of Harry and the Hendersons, Sasquatch, Bigfoot, man in a gorilla suit. This is the same but different.
Yeah, I think so. I think that essentially what might have happened with this kind of like Sasquatch Bigfoot thing is a bit of kind of like importing that legend, right? So when people started to explore the Himalayas and stuff like that, they started kind of bring back this, you know, this kind of like legend, which has, you know, like I said, like really important religious significance.
Tales from the wilderness.
Exactly. And now it's been like, hey, is that that black bear looks an awful lot like a guy in a gorilla suit.
Well, if I dress up my friend Brad in a gorilla suit.
Yeah. Exactly. So I think that one's less up for grabs.
It's a fun little story. There's some interesting details in there about Himalayan culture and bear evolution, so do check it out on the website. Our second story is a little more complicated, dare I say it. Sorry, Nicole, on your podcast debut.
Yeah, thank you for introducing me to the podcast with a story about Bitcoin to follow bears.
Yeah, nothing gets the internet quite so excited as cryptocurrency. And there's been some big Bitcoin news this week with its value.
Yeah, the main piece is that Bitcoin finally topped $10,000 in value, which, if you own any Bitcoin, is quite a lot of money. But there is one number that people have been putting a lot of effort into trying to understand, and we don't really have a good answer. So there isn't an actual answer to this question.
Right. So the question is, how much energy does Bitcoin use? And we've had people flinging around the amount of energy of Ecuador and Ireland and Morocco and all sorts of places. So it's trying to get a grip on the huge amounts of computational power that's required to run this network and then find something to compare it to. Turns out that's hard.
Yeah. So the range that sort of the kind of agreed upon numbers go from 100 megawatts to 3.4 gigawatts, which is, it's really, that's a very, very wide range. It's like me looking at James and saying you're somewhere between 20 and 60. Like it's probably true, but it's just not that helpful.
Yep.
So there's a lot of researchers who are looking into this. They all kind of publish their methodology, and then everyone rips their methodology apart and argues, because that is sort of how Bitcoin works. There's a lot of argument and there's a lot of confusing numbers.
Okay. So why is it so difficult to get a grip on this range? Other than people have different, I guess people who are really supportive of the Bitcoin community might want to suggest that it uses less energy. People who are a bit more skeptical about it might be like, this is a hugely wasteful use of resources. Is that kind of the root of it?
Yeah, there's definitely some cherry picking that goes on. So people kind of come up with a methodology. They'll come up with sort of an equation for coming up with this number, and then they've got to stick their different factors in.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few things that we know. We know how much energy various computing systems use. So when this all first started, everybody was using CPUs. Now they're using more advanced kind of specialist equipment. The top one is apparently the Antminer S9. Mm. Apparently that's the top of the line right now. So we have to take all of that information and try to make a decision about how many people are using each of those different types of hardware, the degree to which they're using it, and kind of the other energy costs that come along with cooling and things like that.
Yeah.
So we're guessing at those. We know that most people are not using CPUs to mine anymore because they're just not good enough.
Yeah.
But we don't know how much they've switched to the top end stuff. So some people just look at those two numbers and pick one in between. So there's an Irish study that came out in 2014, and they picked a number. Their range was 100 megawatts to 100 gigawatts, which is really a very, very wide range.
Yeah, that's vague.
Yeah, so the number that they ended up settling on was 3, which happens to be the consumption of Ireland. They happen to be Irish, and I think it was entirely from patriotism. That's
nice.
My theory.
Nice, yeah. And it's interesting to note, you hinted it there a little bit, is the way that the Bitcoin network has evolved as its popularity has grown. So it started off with, it was pretty much hobbyists and people that were really, really fanatical about this new technology, playing around with it and doing it on conventional consumer hardware. And since then, it's really, really ramped up. So even though there's now a lot more people invested and interested in Bitcoin, because the whole network has professionalized, it's actually way more efficient.
Yeah, so when people first started doing all of this, CPUs were not particularly an efficient model for doing this. But if you want to make money out of this, you need to be using less energy. So all of the professional systems are a lot more efficient. And as Bitcoin mining kind of evolves, it requires more processing power, but the systems have become more efficient. So some of the researchers I spoke to think that it's kind of balanced out a bit. But given they can't actually pick a solid number, we don't really know.
So why should we care? I mean, there's an obvious reason to care about Bitcoin being worth $10,000, because that's mad in a way, or entirely justified if you're really behind the Bitcoin thing. But why does the amount of energy that this network's using matter?
Well, to a lot of people, it won't. You know, if you're looking at just making money or just looking at overthrowing the existing financial system, the environmental impact of that might not be something you particularly care about. But if we are going to look at Bitcoin as a thing that's going to scale across the entire world that we can all use for transactions, right now it is probably too expensive in terms of energy, but also in terms of like actual financial cost per transaction. Mm-hmm. So if we can get those two things down, Bitcoin might be viable. If not, we should possibly just stick with what we have.
Yeah.
So if you see this as an experiment, then great.
Yeah. This is the convenience, cost, and speed argument. So for one thing, Bitcoin's too slow at the moment to be used as a mass financial system. It's also too complicated. Matt, you can probably nod your head and agree with this. Having invested, you're on.
Yeah, I'm big into this. No, I because you just hear Bitcoin hype so much, and I'm like, well, what's this Bitcoin lack about? So I bought a ridiculously small amount of Bitcoin, and yeah, it's difficult. It took like a whole evening.
Yeah, but you know the returns can be great. But compared to this, there was a really interesting stat. We're yet to publish Nicole's article because it's so complicated. It's taking about 4 people 2 days to edit. But we'll get there. The amount of energy that Visa uses as a payment network compared to Bitcoin, or just to kind of put any sort of figure on that, and it kind of makes you realize, oh, all these tiny, tiny little things add up. But even compared to Visa, I mean, Bitcoin is hugely, hugely inefficient currently.
Yeah, the stat that one site, DigiConomist, came up with was that Bitcoin is 20,000 times more demanding than Visa, which doesn't... that takes into account some of Visa networks, but not all of the endpoint systems. So it's impossible to count some of this stuff.
Yeah.
But Bitcoin is definitely not as efficient as the systems we have now. That said, Visa's been around for a long time. These systems have been around for a long time. If we give Bitcoin or digital currencies 20 or 30 years, they will be better. You know, will it be good enough?
Who knows?
I don't have an answer.
No. Nope.
I also don't own any Bitcoin, so.
Well, I guess you don't know. You kind, what, like a tiny portion, fraction of a Bitcoin?
I own 0.006 of a Bitcoin.
Steady.
I know.
Steady.
Big, right? Yeah.
So the conclusion of the article, we set out to answer the question, how much energy does Bitcoin really use? The answer is, we don't know.
But nobody else does either.
No, exactly. So we've gone one step further than anyone else and actually tried to interrogate the numbers. And it's interesting to look at these things because I think it was on the front page of the Financial Times this week when Bitcoin went past $10,000. So this is really, really mainstream now. There are adverts for it on the London Underground. You see them on all over the place now. You know, you get stalked by them around the internet. Maybe that's something to do with my search history. But it knows that I want to be interested in these things. So there are questions to be asked about how efficient it is, if this is a good use of resource. And maybe to finish on this, there's two ways of looking at it. Either it's a bubble or it's not a bubble, right? If it is a bubble, then a load of people are wasting a huge amount of energy on something that is a bubble. If it isn't a bubble, then there's a cost implication here, and companies investing in this really, really need to drive down their capital expenditure.
But on the flip side, even if it is a bubble and this is all going to collapse, it's an experiment into currencies and digital currencies and all of this kind of idea of doing this stuff online and having real anonymity and getting rid of banks as a middle party and all of that. And even though I don't own any Bitcoin, I still think that there's value in that. And is there as much value as, say, American Christmas lights? Yes. So we're willing to spend energy on very silly things. This is an experiment that could one day maybe lead to something useful. So maybe it's worth it.
Are you afraid of the Bitcoin crowd coming after you?
No, I just really like Christmas lights.
Yeah, more Christmas lights, I reckon.
Yeah, more Christmas lights, more Bitcoin, more everything. Okay, we'll do a quiz, and then we've got a special treat for the end of the podcast. Not that a quiz isn't a special treat. So this week, Transport for London announced plans to bring mobile signal to all tube stations and lines, even the tunnels, by 2019. Our listeners in Paris, Berlin, Barcelona, Tokyo, and plenty of other cities around the world might be a little nonplussed by London's comparative not-spottery on the tubes, but throughout its history, London's underground network has been a bastion of, you can get away from everything, essentially. They put Wi-Fi in most of the stations a couple of years ago, and that's been a relative success. So pushed on by that success, they're going to put it everywhere. So I want to know, how much do you know about rapid transit metro train systems?
Nothing.
Ah, well, Nicole might.
More than I'd like to.
Yeah, so.
As a nerd.
Yep. Nicole's husband really likes trains. So, question one. The London Underground is the oldest metro system in the world. What is the second oldest? I'm after a city.
New York?
I'm going to say Boston?
No. Budapest.
Oh, right.
When you started with the B, I was optimistic. Yeah, it opened in 1896, 6 years after the London Underground opened. And it's, I think, one of the lines in Budapest is a World Heritage Site. And everything is still made of wood. It's incredible.
Yeah, I think I've been on that. Cool trains.
Super old. So, 0-0. Good start. As of October 2014, the most recent date which I could find complete data, how many metro transit systems were there in the world?
So, like, a metro transit system is just, like, an underground?
Yeah, but, for example, Tokyo has more than one.
Oh. Well, this is so difficult.
And New York has three.
Mm. And London has one.
Yeah, I guess it would have one. Yeah.
Okay, Nicole, you go first.
See, this is terrible. I'm going to get all these wrong, and then I'm going to get in trouble.
So I'm looking for the number of metro transit systems in the world.
213.
I'm going to go big with, like, 1,500.
Wait, dear me. Come on.
Or is that way too many? What?
Yes.
So
Nicole,
many
you're actually.
Well,
it's true. Nicole, you're quite close. Ish. 160, but it depends how you count them. They're in 157 cities in 55 countries. And if you look at the proposed list of new metro transit systems, it's basically just China.
Oh.
Dozens and dozens of Chinese cities within the next few years will have a metro system. So it will probably be way beyond 230, but still nowhere near the crazy number you said.
One day I'll be right.
One day you'll be right if China keeps on going.
Do I get a point?
You do. 1-0. I'm going to write that down after I ask this question. This is a two-pointer. Ooh. Which city has the most metro stations in the world, and which metro system carries the most passengers per year?
So I guess there's two different answers.
Yes.
Two different cities.
Well, there might not be.
I'm just going to go with Beijing for the most people in terms of... Was the first question the biggest number of stops?
The
most stations. I'm going to go with, I don't know, London.
Nicole.
Most people, I'm going to say Tokyo. And most stations, I'm going to just go back to New York because there's a billion of them there.
You're both right. Yes. New York has the most stations, 425. And that's just the New York subway. That's not New Jersey Transit and the other bits. The most passengers is Beijing.
Oh, cool. Let's share the spoils. Yeah.
So that's 2-1 to Nicole. Beijing has 3,660 million passengers per year.
That's a lot.
Yep. So it's 2-1 to Nicole. Everyone has heard of the London Underground, but which other UK cities have underground railways?
I think Glasgow does.
Oh, that's what I was going to say.
But I can't think of what the other one would be.
Yeah, I'm going to copy Nicole. I think Glasgow as well. Because I remember someone vaguely telling me that. And then the other city is... I'm going to go with Leeds.
I'm going to go with Edinburgh and just assume that they all have underground ones up there.
No. It's Glasgow, so you both get a point, and Newcastle.
Newcastle?
Yep. Cool. Liverpool has 6.5 miles of underground light rail, but it doesn't really count. It's just sort of the terminus of the Merseyrail system goes underground for a little while.
Okay.
Yep. Glasgow and Newcastle have proper underground railways.
That's cool. I like it.
Fun. This is my favourite question, by the way. Number five. It's 2-1 to Nicole. Until an announcement in 2013, what was especially unusual about the Washington, D.C. Metro?
Until an announcement?
Yep. Until something changed, until they made a decision to change something. What was unusual about the Metro system in Washington, D.C.?
I mean, it's a complete guess, but I'm going to say it was completely free of charge.
Okay.
So until an announcement was made,
mm-hmm.
It didn't have announcements before.
Oh, that's brilliant. No, it's also wrong.
I tried.
Both good answers. Nicole, you went over all 2-1. The answer to this question is the trains were carpeted.
Oh, that's awesome.
That is really terrifying.
Yeah. So the trains with carpets have gradually been phased out in recent years. I couldn't find accurate information as to if they're all gone. So if anyone is listening in DC or has been to DC recently and can clarify this for us, please do let me know on Twitter at Jay Temperton. But while it was carpeted, you weren't allowed, apparently, I've never been to DC, you weren't allowed drinks, food, or to smoke on the metro for fear of there being stains on the carpet.
Oh, was it like my mum's living room where you're not allowed your shoes either?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Everyone had to take off their shoes and leave them in a little box by the door.
Makes sense.
It's not the shoes and the drinks. It's if you've been on the tube late at night, it's the result of heavy drinking that's the problem.
Things get sloppy.
You need to be able to hose that down.
Yeah.
It sounds like such a bad idea. Why, you know... And the poles are made out of chocolate. Like, what? Why put carpet on tube? It's so unnecessary.
Yeah, it's a little strange, but they did. I guess it added a sense of class and distinction to proceedings.
Can you imagine having to clean those?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of hoovers, rather than like a hose, which is probably... Well, I mean, it's always quite confusing to some people that on the London Underground, the seats are fabric, and then you go to New York and they're all plastic. So we still have that luxury.
That's a good point, actually. Yeah.
Why not just make everything plastic and then you just like drive the train for a bath at the end of the night?
Yeah.
Apart from they're electric. Okay. Our final special treat. This month's issue of Wired magazine has one of the most famous scientists of all time on the cover, Stephen Hawking. Earlier this year, we had the rare privilege of interviewing Professor Hawking to get his perspective on everything from Donald Trump to the dangers of artificial intelligence. We didn't record the interview live. You can imagine why. So you have to excuse me jumping in slightly oddly with questions to make his answers make sense. It was my colleague Joao Medeiros who did the interview, and he started off by asking Professor Hawking for his views on the current anti-science sentiment.
People distrust science because they don't understand how it works. It seems as if we are now living in a time in which science and scientists are in danger of being held in low and decreasing esteem. This could have serious consequences. I am not sure why this should be, as our society is increasingly governed by science and technology, yet fewer young people seem to want to take up science as a career. One answer might be to announce a new and ambitious space program, to excite them, and stimulate interest in other areas, such as astrophysics and cosmology.
What would you like to say to President Trump if you had the chance to meet him?
I would ask him why he thinks his travel ban is a good idea. This brands as Islamic State terrorists all citizens of six mainly Muslim countries, but doesn't include America's allies such as Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, which allegedly help finance Islamic State. This blanket ban is inefficient and prevents America recruiting skilled people from these countries. I would also ask him to renounce his denial of climate change. But again, I fear neither will happen, as Trump continues to appease his electorate.
You've warned us before about the perils of AI. Do you think that AI will be part of the scientific process or even replace scientists?
The genie is out of the bottle. We need to move forward on artificial intelligence development, but we also need to be mindful of its very real dangers. I fear AI may replace humans altogether. If people design computer viruses, someone will design AI that improves and replicates itself. This will be a new form of life that will outperform humans.
Do you worry about the control that big corporations like Facebook and Google increasingly have in the dissemination of information and news?
I worry about the control big corporations increasingly have over information. The danger is we get into the situation that existed in the Soviet Union with their two newspapers, Pravda, which means truth, and Investa, which means news. The joke was, there was no truth in Pravda, and no news in Investa. Big corporations will always promote stories that reflect well on them, and suppress those that don't.
What scientific work should be pursued most urgently in order to solve a significant problem that society is facing today?
My preference would be to rigorously pursue a space exploration program, with a view to eventually colonizing suitable planets for human habitation. I believe we have reached the point of no return. Our Earth is becoming too small for us, global population is increasing at an alarming rate, and we are in danger of self-destructing. Whether this would be the result of damage to the environment, or a nuclear war of devastating proportions, we need to actively pursue an alternative way of living, if the human race is to survive for another 1,000 years.
As I said, slightly weird, but it is really cool to actually hear him answering the questions. I think it really kind of adds to the points he's trying to make. You know, he's got such a unique voice. And I always find it amazing that even though he's been offered a number of opportunities to change his voice because new technology has become available, he said, no, that's my voice. That's how I talk. And it's instantly recognizable. So you can read the interview in full, although you've just heard it in full, in the latest issue of Wired magazine, along with interviews with some of the world's most distinguished scientists in fields from string theory to, well, we've got astronauts, we've got Neil deGrasse Tyson, we've got Jill Tata, Jim Al-Khalili, Catherine Hayhoe. It's an amazing lineup, and they've got some really amazing things to say. And we're also publishing the interviews in a lot greater length on the Wired website over the next few days, so you can check them out there if you want to read some more. We'll leave it there for this week. Thank you very much. See you again next week. Goodbye.